I would like to state my appreciation of that picture by Nimai of Krishna. It's a beautiful picture. Very jolly and not very nice blue. It's as good as anything I could do. Very good. Bhagavatasi isn't here, is she?
No.
Does anyone see her regularly?
No.
Because she gave me a book. She thought I might be interested in it, but I'm not.
Okay.
You can give it back to her. Today is Easter Sunday on the Christian calendar, so I thought of giving a class which would be a combination of the narration of the resurrection of Jesus Christ with parallel comments about Krishna and his going to the spiritual world, and then after that, some down to earth talk about our own position and hopes for ascending to the spiritual world. So I'll start with the narration, which is familiar to many of you in this country, about what happened to Jesus Christ after he was crucified. So the Roman soldiers turned his body over to his relatives, who was his mother, Mary, and Mary Magdalene, and another woman. And he was a criminal, considered a criminal, so normally there would be no tomb or anything, they'd just be thrown to the dogs and the wolves. But his disciples didn't want that indignity. And he had one disciple who was highly placed. His name was James. And from a place called Arithma. And he was actually on a body of the Sanhedrin, which was the big Jewish council. You know, Jerusalem was ruled by the Romans in the vast Roman Empire. But in Jerusalem, the Jews had a big temple, and they had their representation there. So the Romans, in order to rule, they had to honor the Jewish presence to some degree. So it was according to the Bible, it was the Jews who got all riled up about the preaching of Jesus and the revolutionary way he preached against the Orthodox Jewish religion. And they got more and more riled up. And so finally, through one of his disciples, Judas, he was turned over to this group, the Sanhedrin, and it was like a lynching party. Judas was told it was just going to be a meeting where Jesus could present his case, but there was no such thing, and they said, "Do you think you're God? And do you make these different claims?" And James, he was in favor of Jesus, but he didn't speak out. And sort of a mystery whether he was afraid to speak out or thought it was hopeless or whatever. But he didn't speak anything. But the commentators say it was a shame that in that meeting, if Jesus was, you know, was completely, everyone was against him, if he could have just heard one kind word of one of those powerful men saying, I think this is a good man, I think these charges are false, and he's done great work. But nobody spoke in his favor. So the chief man, Caiaphas, said, turn him over to Pilate, the Roman emperor, and he can do with him what he wants. And then that led to Pilate, who was, he wasn't so much against Jesus either. He just wanted to keep peace. But he devised this plan that he would turn two people over, either this criminal Barabbas, who had killed a Roman soldier, or Jesus. And so he had the people choose, and they said, who do you want to be freed? And they said, give us Barabbas, give us Barabbas. And so that was the decision that Jesus would be killed. So after the after the crucifixion, this man James came forward, and he asked Pilate, could I give Jesus a proper burial? And Pilate said, all right. And he got some linen, and he had a new cave that had never been used before, which is a typical place to bury them. And he prepared this place with a big rock in front of it. And they were going to have a decent burial. But the Romans knew about these preparations. So one of them said, it was going over on the weekend. Jesus, as you know, Good Friday was when he was killed. And Saturday is the day of the Sabbath, when the Jews don't do any activity. So Sunday is the day of the resurrection. So the Romans said, over this weekend, I want you to post guards all over this tomb, just in case these Jews come and try to remove the rock and take the body away, and then they'll spread this rumor that that Jesus was resurrected or his body disappeared in some sacred way. And don't worry, we'll give you so much money that you'll be protected in case anybody said, the soldiers fell asleep and that's how it happened. So the soldiers took the money. So then Sunday morning came, and the ladies came, those brave ladies, the two Marys and another lady, and they had these different ointments they were going to put on his body. But then they thought, how are we going to remove this big rock? But when they got there, the rock was removed. They were amazed, and they entered the tomb, and there are different versions in the different little versions, but the main fact is the rock was removed. In one version, there was a gardener inside, and he said, why are you here? He said, well, we're looking for our Lord who was died, and we want to prepare his body with ointments. He said, why are you looking for the living in the place of the dead? He's not here. But in other versions, there were much more glorious angels and bathed in white, and they said the same thing. Why are you looking for the living in the place of the dead? So the ladies, in great fright and confusion, they ran out from the tomb, and they ran to where the 11 apostles were in hiding from the Jews, and they ran into them and said, we've seen the Master. Wait a minute, did they see him? They said, no, we entered the tomb, and he's not there. And we saw angels, and his body is gone. So, did they see, does anybody know whether they saw Jesus at that point? He did appear to them? He appeared to them. So, with even more ecstasy, they ran to the disciples, said, we've seen the Master, he has risen. And all these great disciples who we know through history, you know, who wrote the Gospels and everything, Peter and Luke and Thomas and John and everything, they said, this is nonsense. You're just babbling like women. We don't believe this. And how could he have risen from the dead? But the one who had been the coward at the crucial moment, Peter, who was later made the Pope, or the rock on whom the church would rest, he took off and ran, at least. He ran to the tomb to see what it was, he and another. And when he got there, he saw the tomb was empty, and there were linens there, and so he became convinced that something extraordinary had happened. So that's the first revelation or episode from the Gospels. This wonderful movie by Zeffirelli, they have a scene where when the tomb is empty and the ladies go in there and they see it, then this man, he's like the villain, he's done everything to persecute and nail Christ to the cross. He was even the one who posted the soldiers overnight. And then he goes there and he sees the tomb is empty and he sees the linens are there and he says, now it begins. Meaning that no matter all he tried, he's defeated. Now the story will begin, that he was no ordinary man and he rose from the dead. So the next story of his being resurrected is a more homely one, is that two men are walking along a road some days later. Jesus then disappears after that scene in the tomb. And so two men are walking along the road in a town called Emmaus. There's even a town in Pennsylvania now called Emmaus. And they're sort of ordinary Jews. And they're joined by another man who they can't recognize. And they're talking, they're full of grief, all about these events that happened in Jerusalem with Jesus and crucifixion. And there's talk of a resurrection, and the lady saw this. He said, what's all this? You're talking back and forth. And he said, what? You haven't heard? He said, you must be the only man in Jerusalem who haven't heard all these things. He said, what things? And they tell him some more. And he says, oh, you must be hard-hearted people that you don't understand these events. These events were all predicted in the scriptures, that the Lord would come, he would be crucified, and he would rise, and all these things would happen. How could you not understand these things? They're quite surprised. This is actually Jesus who's walking with them, but they can't recognize him. And then he's about to go on. They're about to stop in their house, and he's about to go on his own. He said, could you stay with us and come into our house? So he goes with them, and they sit down together, and they have some, they eat together, they have some bread, and he breaks the bread and blesses it. And as he distributes the bread, they realize that he's Jesus. So then they get all excited and they run back to this place that's called the upper room, where again, in fear and hiding, the disciples are always so dependent on Jesus. They're like his little children and always somewhat fearful, but still they're his faithful. But there they are again, hiding in the upper room, and these men come to them and say, we just met Jesus on the road, and he told us these things. And now Jesus appears in the upper room to all the disciples, but they're afraid, and they say, are you a spirit or are you a real person? He said, no, I'm a real person. He said, touch me, feel me, I'm actually a person. And you should realize this. They do. And then to confirm this, he says, do you have anything here to eat? And they give him something to eat. And then that's like the confirmation that that he has resurrected, and he says in effect, now you know who I am, and I'm the Savior, and I've come, and you're my disciples, but I don't want you to just stay in this room forever. And he gives them their orders, and he says, he stresses the urgency of the task. Out to all men, call to repentance and offer of forgiveness. The church was not left to live forever in the upper room. It was sent out into all the world. After the upper room came the worldwide mission of the church. The days of sorrow were past, and the tidings of joy must be taken to all men. So, some parallels to Krishna consciousness. Some of them not in agreement with this. First of all, a lot of hardcore Christians say that Christ was extraordinary because he was the only person who died and came back to life. That's not even in concord with the Bible. In the Old Testament, there were many persons, prophets, Isaiah and other prophets, who did this. They died and then they resurrected and came back to life. So Jesus was not the only one who did this. There was once a born-again kind of parade in a nearby town in Giranagari, and they had these different floats, you know, like Giranagari floats, like Radhyatra floats, and one of them was Krishna, and it had like the years that he lived, such and such to such and such, dead, and then it had a tomb, and it had Buddha, such and such, dead, you know, and Muslim, dead, Buddha, or Muhammad, dead. And then they had Jesus, that he never died, the only person who ever died. So that was a very important claim to them, but it's not a fact. As specifically for Krishna's so-called dying, and in turn to the 11th canto, 12th canto, there are even some cults in India that revere Krishna but believe this about him. I don't want to guess for sure, but I think maybe the Swami Narayan sect believes this about him. So, he finally left when a hunter shot him with an arrow. Supposedly this came from a curse by Dhritarashtra's wife, Gandhari, because Krishna promised he wouldn't take part in the war, and then he did. Just then a hunter named Jara, who had approached the place, mistook the Lord's foot for a deer's face. Thinking he had found his prey, Jara pierced the foot with his arrow, which he had fashioned from the remaining iron fragment of Sambha's club. Now, Vishwanath Vyasadeva's words are always to be taken as absolute, but sometimes the commentaries by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and others go even deeper into other scriptures and other understandings to give us esoteric meanings. So he says less than esoteric meaning, less than the obvious. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, the statement that the arrow pierced the Lord's foot expresses the point of view of the hunter who thought he had struck a deer. In fact, the arrow merely touched the Lord's lotus foot and did not pierce it, since the Lord's limbs are composed of eternity, knowledge, and bliss. Otherwise, in the description of the next verse, that the hunter became fearful and fell down with his head upon the Lord's feet, Shukadeva Goswami would have stated that he extracted his arrow from the Lord's foot. And the next text says, then seeing that four-armed personality The hunter became terrified of the offense he had committed, and he fell down, placing his head upon the feet of the enemy of the demons. So if the hunter felt so bad about it, he would have removed the arrow that he had shot in his foot. And here's a picture. Let me pass it around. It shows that the arrow is in the ground. How are we doing? When in the upper room, Jesus, that's called Pentecost, that after that event, Jesus breathed fire into his disciples and they became fiery preachers, no longer timid. They went out and spread the word all over the world. Most of them became martyrs and they could perform great miracles. Anything they did had great effect. They could bring people back to life as much as Jesus could. So this is one of the empowerments that happened at Pentecost. Christians talk about breathing, what do they call it? Talking in tongues and all these fabulous things that they were able to do after they were empowered by Jesus. This is my emergency. Do you drink emergency, anybody? It's supposed to give you a lift. But in Krishna Leela and Lord Chaitanya Leela, there are many, many devotees like that too. And I'll name some of them. Lord Chaitanya personally cured Vasudev Datta of leprosy. He cured Amoga of leprosy. He cured Sanatana Goswami's sores. He embraced 7 tall trees from Ramalila, and they went back to Godhead. He liberated Shivananda Sen's dog. He brought Shivas Thakur's son back to life. And Narada and Angira restored Chitraketu's son. Rama restored the dead Varnaras after the battle with Ravana. Ramdas Abhiram in Chaitanya Leela used to be able to give love of God by touching people with his whip. Krishna restored Devaki's sons and Sandipandi Muni's sons. Krishna gave a new body to Parikshit in the womb. And Prabhupada's comment on most of the Christian miracles is that they are yoga siddhis. That are extraordinary, but are done by not a lot of people, but not only by one son of Jesus Christ, or one son of God. I have some nice pictures of the Christian ascension. I can pass it around. Here's the ascension, a picture of the ascension of Jesus. He appears to be still standing on the ground with the pole, and the disciples are looking up at heaven, and then the man in white is an angel.
And then, as the doctrine, Jesus taught a very simple doctrine that developed over the years, especially the developers were St. Paul. He almost made the Christian religion compared to the simple things that Jesus taught. And then much later, St. Augustine, he made a lot of stress on it, taught it. And and then gradually, more and more praise of the mother of Jesus developed. And it came to the point that she was accepted as also having the word is assumption was more used. Jesus Christ ascended into heaven, and she made an assumption into God. Here's a beautiful sort of a middle-aged type picture of all the angels bringing about the assumption of Mary. Thank you. And here's a couple more small ones. I'm sure in Ireland you've all seen these kind of pictures. Very pious. So as you see them, let us think about ascension in Krishna consciousness. Balaram returned to the spiritual world as a white Sheshanaga. Rama called his citizens together, gave final instructions, and ascended into the sky with his brothers, who took their forms as his chakra, etc. I think there's a picture of that in the BBT book. Lord Chaitanya, how did he go back? Anybody remember? Yeah, he entered the Tota Gopinath deity. Mother Sita, anybody remember? Entered the earth. Narottam Das Thakur, how did he disappear? Gopi. All just what? Yeah, in the water by turning into milk while being massaged. Here's one you may not know, it's not in our line. Madhvacharya. So he was in his last hours and he was about to disappear. And his disciples were placing more and more flowers upon his form. And then when they removed the flowers, he was gone. He had disappeared under the flower petals. There's a story from the literature of Tukaram, who's a disciple of Lord Chaitanya, at least by mystical connection, although some of the Tukaram followers may deny that historically. So he got a message from his deity of Vishnu, who's called Vitthal. It's a very nice new book, Penguin book, of the poems of Tukaram. It's written in free verse. And so he got his message from Vitthal that I've been invited to go back to the spiritual world, and I'm going to go on Wednesday. So anybody who wants to go with me, you can just I'll be in the marketplace. You can just hold on my hands and we'll all go back together. So although that wasn't a time of so much preaching your realizations, because he was a disciple of Lord Chaitanya, he preached it to save others. And he went into the marketplace, and people gathered around, and he held out his hands, and everyone kind of stood back, and nobody took his hands. Okay, so now here's what I call the down to earth about ourselves. Should we want to go back to Godhead or ascend to the spiritual world? Dina? At the call on evil. Yeah, I think, yeah, you could say, well, even if I put it, should we want to, if I say, do you want to, you may say, well, I really don't, I'm only thinking of this and that. But you know you should want to, because that's our, Prabhupada teaches that, that's certainly something we want to do. We don't want to stay in this material world, or we don't believe that there is this, an ascension for us to go back to Godhead. So, yes, we should want to go back to Godhead, to the spiritual world, and play with Krishna, as Prabhupada would say. I've got 8 questions, so we'll take our time. This one's a little longer. You have to listen to it. Cultivating a desire to ascend to Godhead requires cultivating an understanding that the material world is an unhappy place. But our happiness in this world is mixed, and therefore we find it difficult to give up the hope of finding our ultimate happiness here. The spiritual world also seems to be a far-off goal, one of which we have no experience and no chance of experience until we attain it. How can we strengthen our resolve to aspire for something we've only been told will be good for it if we have no direct realization about it? The doctrine is that this material world is dukkhalayam ashashvatam, unhappy. But we don't find it all that way. Like living here in Wicklow, there's so many nice things. We have nice family life, nice surroundings, but there are difficulties. We have to make money. So it's kind of a mixture, but a lot of it is nice. Also, life is nice, and life is not nice. It's difficult maybe to think that we couldn't somehow, if we could get it together, find happiness here. Maybe we could find happiness here. But then if you say, no, you couldn't find happiness here, you have to go to the spiritual world, then, well, where is that spiritual world? We passed out those pictures and it all seemed so unrealistic. They're looking up and what are they looking up at and where is it and so forth, or even Krishna Loka. How can we strengthen our resolve to aspire for something we have only been told will be good for us if we have no direct realization of it? So I hope that question is clear enough. It's sort of, should we just stick it out here and think, well, this is probably the best there is and I'll just try to make my happiness here? Or should we just really think it's not here and just try to really direct our sights to that other place? Anybody not understand? Well, it's a little unclear. Okay. Yes?
I was thinking that here, it's quite nice here. That's because we are kind of, to the degree we are thinking of a spiritual world, it's nice here. But if we forget completely about spiritual worlds, it wouldn't be really nice here. We would be so much tormented by the desires, and you never attain what you want, and and then you're getting older and older. And it's really like you're losing the whole point. And, but and the second part would be like, well, the people who went there, they came, went back to the spiritual world, and even like Prabhupada, he would be a very good example, or like even associating with people like Narottam Das Thakur or Tulsidas Bhajans or people like that, they put their emotions in their songs or their poetry, and then you could relate to that, and you can get a little bit of
That's very important to read spiritual literature and associate with spiritual masters, so that it becomes a reality through that way. When you go to sing a bhajan or get in touch with it by the reading and the hearing. What else do we have? And then, as you said, even enduring the material world, we can push on with it, knowing that there is, that we're doing it with a sense of spiritual reality behind, underneath it.
Yeah, for example, somebody may be born in ISKCON and he never seen world outside of spiritual kind of aspirations and goals. He would think, oh, well, it's quite a nice place. But the reality is that he's surrounded by the spiritual atmosphere and energy, whatever way it may be. And he thinks, oh, he's never seen anything else.
I think the point when I was thinking about, well, how to make something more real that seems so far away.
I
often think of that too, how because it's like when I'm so much engrossed as an adult in the material world, there's the relief of like what we were saying about associating with devotees. So I don't always feel the great urgency and have to do more because we're so buffered and comforted by each other's association through the ups and downs of our life here in the material realm, and at the same time aspiring for something more. But when I think about, well, could there really be a place where these troubles don't exist, where you don't just have to ride the waves, you know? And when I feel like that, it helps when I just go before Krishna and Balaram and Vrindavan, and I just look at them and I just feel so much they're just saying, well, just come and play. What are you doing out there? You know, don't you want to come and play? Just come and play. And you think, and I think, yes, I have to think childlike again. You know, like children, they're not concerned about, oh, how are you making money, how are you living, you know, what's my profession going to be, how am I going to take care of the family. They just, they have that natural spontaneity to just amuse themselves through play. You know, when I see Krishna Balaram there, their cowherd ropes and their flutes and their bugle horns, and you really feel that invitation from them. So the deities are so much a part of being able to draw us to the spiritual world, you know. And like how you have those like 3D pictures, you know, you have to focus your eye in the middle of the picture, then it becomes 3D, and you can see a whole other realm. Sometimes I think it's like that when you go to see the deities, you try to look, you know, beyond the front of it and try to see the whole scope, you know. That's through the Acharya's eyes only, we know it's there. Wonderful.
And if it's undeniable that we have to live in that live in this world, we have to also know that the other world is, like you say, that it is there. The world of this, playing with Krishna is there, and when he wants to take us, we'll go there, patient. But to be childlike and want to go there at once is nice. And let's see. If we strengthen our resolve to ascend to Godhead, how is that different from salvationism? Then I define salvationism something we've been told is selfish, lacking in devotional service, just thinking that I just want to save myself, I want to save my soul and get out of here, save my skin and get out of all these hassles and just go back to Godhead. Really building up the resolve to ascend to Godhead, how is that different than salvationism?
If we're thinking of ourselves and our relationship with Krishna, is that Krishna wants us back there, we're meant to serve him. So it's not a matter of ourselves getting out of the situation, but staying ourselves where we should be. And that's a joy to Krishna. That's actually giving him pleasure. So we change it from our own wish for pleasure and peace and happiness to just turn ourselves over to Krishna.
That's what he wants.
Yeah.
He wants you back.
Yeah. It's in response to his desire, actually.
That's good. I have another question later that may be a little little in conflict with it, but rather than bring it up now, I'll bring it up later. This question I'm going to ask for Shilavati to answer, so get ready. Sometimes devotees feel cultivating a desire to ascend to the spiritual world is antithetical to living a full life in this world. Do you want to comment on this? Some devotees feel cultivating a desire to ascend to the spiritual world is against living a full life in this world. Do you want to comment on this?
I was in my fired-up state, like, and I wanted to, this is my goal, you know, to go back to the spiritual world. And I renounced a lot of things falsely. I thought this is the right thing. I wasn't living my full life. You know. So I found when I went back to do my acting and doing things that I'd given up because I thought it was going to make me more spiritual, but actually I felt more fulfilled because it became more real. My spiritual life became more real then. It was like, yes, it is one of my desires, a very big part of my desires, but I also can't just renounce everything else. Go there because I'm not ready and I don't have a strong enough desire and I don't know Christian. So it would be a gradual thing for me.
Could you say because it's more real, because it's more who you are?
Yeah, for me, yeah. And I feel more real than talking to somebody. You know, if I'm talking about spiritual life to somebody, I feel like that I'm not on any big pedestal. You know, I can't be, I'm not able to be, I'm not, so I feel more real when I'm talking to somebody because they're more real with me.
I said, do you want to comment on this? I had a comment. It says, some devotees feel cultivating a desire to ascend to the spiritual world is antithetical to living a full life in this world. Do you want to comment on this? And I said, it can be. The desire to ascend to the spiritual world can be against living a full life in this world. Because there's so many beautiful things in this world
that are part of God's creation and part of spiritual life, and a person could have a too narrow view of what spiritual life is, too renounced, and maybe be brought up by strict nuns or somebody who taught them that these things weren't good, that the body wasn't good, that the world wasn't good, and they gave those things up unnecessarily. And then I thought of an example of one of the saints that I very much like, Teresa of Lisieux, who died when she was 25. And there was this book full of praise of her, and someone said, you know, she's maybe one of the best saints that ever was. She said, of course, there are some things that she wasn't perfect and we could say. She said, for example, it could be said that she didn't have a love of life. So that was considered by him as something favorable that even a saint could have. And for example, the night that she suddenly felt a big outburst of something in her mouth, something erupted in her mouth, and she waited till the morning to see what it was. And then in the morning, she spit it out and saw what it was, and it was blood. And she knew that this was, whatever it was, cancer, or this was her soon death. And she was full of joy when she saw this, that she would be going back to Jesus so soon. So that's very wonderful. But it could be said that the other is wonderful too. To want to love the world, like Saint Francis of Assisi, how he loved the world and the birds, and the brother tree and the brother moon and all that kind of stuff. So I would say that it depends on the saint or the spiritual person, but desiring a cultivation to ascend to the spiritual world. Could be, in some persons, developed to such a narrow degree. We think of like the puritanical people and their attitudes towards life and the body, the punishment of the body, and all these things that were given by God, and how they think that these are not spiritual things, and they deny them, and that seems to be, especially nowadays, it seems to be the source of a lot of frustration that has turned into, of course, a lot of this talk about pedophilic priests, and saying, you know, well, maybe if things were loosened up a little bit, people wouldn't think that they had to give up everything just to become saintly. So some commentary on that. Anyone else want to talk about that?
Yeah. Even if you think of intent, like my relationship with Krishna, what I'm trying to develop is that I always get this feeling from reading the scriptures that somehow there should be a point I'm hoping to come to where my attraction for Krishna becomes so great that the other things become pale. That I can go through a lot of stages where I appreciate so much in nature, myself having studied horticulture, and I'm so much attracted by Saint Francis to the other living creatures, and even, you know, doing charitable things. But I'm always hoping that my attraction to Krishna, I always wish that would become as great as some of my, you know, feelings of wanting to be merciful or compassionate to other living entities. I would think, well, gee, I, like when Christmas would come every year, we would be in the mall selling the paintings, and I would hear the hymns or the old Christmas songs, and my heart would well, you know, with feelings, with emotion from those days of, you know, worshiping Jesus like that, or now at Easter. And I think, well, when can I sing those songs, when can I sing those bhajans of like Narottam Das Thakur, Bhakti Vinod Thakur, and have that same feeling well in my heart? And I used to think, well, what is it, just material conditions? That, like, oh, because I grew up as a Christian as a child, so, you know, these things are big But there was a sense of a relationship with God even then. But I somehow haven't yet been able to totally give it over to Krishna in an emotional sense, in that deeper heart sense. It still seems a little far away, not so close.
Mm. Okay. Six, some devotees say they don't pray or cultivate their desire to ascend to Godhead because Prahlad Maharaj taught something different. Whether in heaven or hell, we should be satisfied to serve the Lord purely. What often happens, however, is with pure devotion out of reach and with the spiritual world not a goal, our Krishna consciousness remains unfocused. Is it helpful for devotees to cultivate their desire to return to ascend to the spiritual world? So essentially this is saying, well, wait a minute, we're supposed to be preaching. That's more important than thinking about going back to Godhead. You know, we should be thinking about food for life and distributing books, and never mind whether we go to back to Godhead. So such devotees don't pray or cultivate their desire to go back to Godhead. And they cite, well, Prahlad Maharaj said something different. Yeah.
It seems that it's really not a question of cultivating your desire to be spiritual, but cultivating your desire to be spiritual. Because why would you want to go to the spiritual world? It's an esoteric thing, you don't even know where you're going to. But you have to have some experience of that. And in your life, whether you're married or single or whatever, your life is becoming spiritualized, then a natural consequence is to go to the spiritual world, because that's what you're really interested in.
Right.
And I think, just hearing different points, I also can identify when you're young, brought up as a Christian, it was part of your life to be a Christian. Maybe not very defined, but it's still part of your life, so you can identify with it. And even that was what he still identified, even though it was many, many years ago.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel I came to Krishna consciousness as a young adult, so.
These are just different aspects of Krishna consciousness. If Prahlad Maharaj says he's satisfied to serve the Lord purely, well, he'll go back to Godhead by preaching to the mudhas, whether he desires it or not. And Lord Chaitanya says, janmani janmani ishvari bhavati bhakti bhavati. I don't care if I go back to Godhead. But in other places, Krishna says, he will be brought back to Godhead, that devotee. For such a pure devotee, for such a pure desire to not even want to go back to Godhead but to save others, the Lord will bring him back to Godhead or send him back here. It doesn't matter. It's kind of a moot point. Yeah.
Is it okay if I back up one
question?
Yeah. Am I strange, but I love going to burning ghats. Yeah. I find it incredibly life-affirming or incredibly good for Krishna consciousness or something. Mm. I think one of the best days I ever spent was on the overlooking the burning ghat in Varanasi, and just watching them bring the body, one body after another, one after another, one after another, and burning them. Because I just found it very sobering and uplifting that everything here is temporary. Why burden yourself so much? We're just passing through very, very quickly. And, you know, and don't worry about it.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't know what I'm trying to say. I'm just saying that sometimes I personally find the audience watching death uplifting.
Yeah.
And I like being in places where the it's good to see people like with leprosy.
Yeah.
And then I go, I know that could be me.
Yeah.
Just a few sinful activities or whatever, or some, you know, I could be that.
Yeah.
So, you know, then I feel thankful. I'm not there, I'm thankful. So,
yeah.
So it's this combination. I can understand Teresa, St. Teresa, when she threw up and she said, oh, great, I'm dying.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I feel that brave. I'm not, maybe I'm not that brave, but I'm not. I don't find this world like a really good place or a lovely place to be, and I'm interested in what's going to happen next.
Yeah. Well, I think those are certainly right Krishna conscious ideas. Though there's that expression, what is the Sanskrit word about the burning, going to the burning ghat, but only having a temporary renunciation. So if you go to the burning ghat all day, and then you go to the enjoy on the next day, then it hasn't had effect.
Yeah.
But it really has an effect on you, that's me, that's what's going to become of me.
I don't find it sad or depressing. I don't find it sad or depressing. I guess some people would, but I don't. I just look at it and I go, wow, this is the reality of creation, of our destination, the reality of after we get it together. Time's running out. I only have so much time, and it's running out.
But fortunately, you have just like, say, if a Buddhist went there, he would probably have a different realization than you. He would say, it's similar, and some would say that this is it. This is all there is, and then it's over.
Right.
But you have, this is it, this is over, but I have to get my Krishna consciousness together so that I can be with Krishna.
Right. And what also strikes me in those situations is the rarity of human life. It's like we only have this like short window of opportunity. It's like the human form of life is it. You either got to get it together and ascend, or you don't, and then you got to come back again as who knows what.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like that also strikes me.
Right. Well, yeah, just like the Mahal Krishna Maharaj is passing away, which is a shock. And it's sort of the same thing that you just mentioned. Such a short a window of opportunity for such a valuable person. Is there such a thing as ascending to Godhead in the mind while the body remains in the world? What kind of consciousness would we have to have to attain that state? Pranada, you have a... What is there such a thing as ascending to Godhead or going back to Godhead in the mind while the body remains in this world? What kind of consciousness would we have to attain that state? It's like a state of mental...
The wording is a little strange. I don't think of the mind, because going back to Godhead means leaving the subtle and the gross body. So it's really a state of the being. And you know, definitely everything in prophet's books points to the possibility of actually being in this world and not at this world, and actually being back to Godhead before the physical body drops. Like, in describing how simple reactions accumulate and manifest, we have this physical being that, even if the soul actually attains its full position as serving Krishna, it stays in this physical being until the physical being drops and is finished according to the past karma or Krishna's desire. So I would say the answer is yes, but by the wording of that, not in mind, but in soul. You saw it with Prabhupada. I remember him sitting on the Vyasasam in Los Angeles and getting a really strong impression of that, and all he was doing was taking his sweater off
that I felt very strongly, he wasn't just, he wasn't of this world, and the actual act of even taking the sweater off was a spiritual.
Here's a question that would sort of maybe go against that. With so many things to do in this life, how can we find the, I won't use mental, spiritual space to concentrate on ascending to what feels like a mystical or perhaps not quite real world? Uddhava? A busy man.
That was the kind of point I was making, that you're right, visible of things. And so you have to cultivate them in such a way that they're favorable, because they are full of things. It's not like you can just go to the spiritual world and leave everything else you've been doing for the last 20, 15 years. You know, so that's too esoteric for me anyway, to think of the spiritual world, some other place that things go on. I remember reading the Krishna with Prince of the example of the cows walking out to pasture and eating grass. I think I mentioned this before. I thought, oh, eating grass? The cows eat the grass. The cows eat grass? That's amazing. I didn't think they do something selfish like that. They're all worshiping Krishna. But they eat grass, you know. So the point I'm making is that you do things. You know, you actually, your life is full of, it should be in connection with Krishna. But it doesn't have to be so, oh, I don't, these are the things I need to hang because I do them for myself. But these things are for Krishna. Yeah. Somehow or other, it's all part of the wholesome idea. And I know there's absolutely no mission for me to ascend in the spiritual world if I'm living this, you know, the clouds be open or whatever. It's just not going to happen. And I don't aspire to that anyway, because I wouldn't like to go to a place where I have to leave half of myself behind.
Yeah. It sounds a little bit like Vaikuntha, where it seems to be more just worshiping Krishna rather than doing that.
Almost official.
Yeah.
Makes me think of like the whole quandary I go through when I read the Bhagavad Gita. The whole question always comes up, whether there's activities and Arjuna is expected to do them, and he's naturally a kshatriya, so he doesn't want to do those particular activities because they're distasteful at this particular time. But then in Krishna, he's trying to take him to a higher platform of connecting his activities and saying, well, you do the same activity, but now because you're doing it for my pleasure, it's no longer actually the same activity.
Right.
You know, that whole concept, like Prana was saying about Prabhupada, I always find that a great mystery when I read those passages in Bhagavatam of how the material nature becomes spiritualized by how you direct it. Not that necessarily you change the activity, but that very activity, I'd probably say, my devotees, they may act and they may appear to be doing the same activities as ordinary persons, but actually they're engaged in the devotional service of the Lord. Now we find that a great mystery, actually, how that is.
Another perspective, somebody could be a pujari for less than years before he dies, and people will be doing the same thing here that he will be doing there.
Right.
He will be doing all the small things and busy every day, getting up every day in the morning and bringing flowers to Krishna, picking them up and cleaning the temple and decorating the deity. He will be doing the same thing there.
Be satisfied. We should be satisfied with whatever we're doing here. If we're doing it for Krishna. Yeah.
I don't think the spiritual has to remain so mysterious and ethereal to us. I think that's why the acharyas have given us Vrindavan. That if we go to Vrindavan in Mayapur, and if we immerse ourselves in Vrindavan, we'll experience the spiritual world. It's not so far away. It's not like a mysterious thing. You just have to go and immerse yourself in Vrindavan, and you'll taste Krishna. So the thing is, it's 90 miles off New Delhi. You get on a train and go there, and you just try to immerse yourself as deeply as possible in Vrindavan, and you'll taste, you'll experience the spiritual. So I don't know. I also think it's the nice thing about Vaishnavism and in in juxtaposition to Christianity, we have the pictures and they're looking up and they don't know what's there. They're looking up. It's the great mystery in the sky. But to us, it's not a great mystery what's there. And you can go over downhill, it's still there. And it's a concrete. It's concrete. And if you circumambulate it in the right mood and with the right feeling, and even with the wrong mood and with the wrong feeling, still you can feel it's something very special about this place. You really can't put your finger on exactly all the time, but it's extremely special.
You have finishing comment?
Yeah. Well, I don't want to sound contented, but to get that point, you know, you can do this here I live in Wicklow. And my experience going to Vrindavan, sometimes I got that, but most times you listen to politics in the restaurant. But it's really a challenge, I suppose, that you have to capture that mood. Or whatever it is. For me, it's not even a mood. It's just that, you know, you have to think of Krishna, and your activities have to remind you of Krishna. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was beautiful what Vidyanagari said after you and Vrindavan, an undeniable. But it has to be worldwide, too. Referencing the Bhagavad Gita. The special qualification of the pure devotee is that he is always thinking of Krishna without deviation and without considering the time or place. There should be no impediments. He should be able to carry out his service anywhere and at any time. Some say that the devotee should remain in holy places like Vrindavan or some holy town where the Lord lived. But a pure devotee can live anywhere and create the atmosphere of Vrindavan by his devotional service. It was Sri Advaita who told Lord Chaitanya, "Wherever you are, O Lord, there is Vrindavan." So that Rupa Goswami said, one should live in Vrindavan 24 hours a day, but if he cannot, then he should think of Vrindavan.
Sort of like the question you were saying about the mental state of being in the spiritual world, but still physically being on this plane.
Yeah.
That meditation, like now you come back from a pilgrimage and you think how to keep those images in the mind, you know,
yeah.
Hearing the peacocks and the parrots,
yeah.
You know, bathing, and you bring back some dust or holy water,
right.
And try to get a sprinkle or
right.
Try to immerse yourself again.
Anada has a whole Vrindavan meditation she does every day, from Prabhupada Samadhi to Krishna Balaram to this place and that place, which has to be refreshed, no doubt, occasionally by going there. Dina?
I was just thinking of a story. I'm not sure where the story comes from, but there's been four people, and I just remember two of them, the butcher, especially different than their bird life, but the devotee, it doesn't matter if they live their lives, because these, you know, two more, I can't remember what they are, but it's just like what you're saying, but can you have, without leaving your body, can you retain the spiritual world?
The king's son should die soon. No, the king's son should live a long time because he's enjoying like anything, and once he dies, he's going to go to hell. The brahmachari is performing so much austerity, so he should die soon because then he'll get high reward for his austerity. But the pure devotee, doesn't matter whether he lives or dies because he's already in Krishna consciousness. The butcher, because he, when he lives, he's in hell, and when he dies, he's in hell.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking that, it seems to me like there's plenty of stuff in the material world that doesn't seem so real. New York City, no, different. A few things around work well, pretty unreal. Oh, and generally, you know, wherever you go, if you travel, it doesn't necessarily automatically seem real. You can feel out of place here. And you can feel more at home doing devotional things. Or in different, you can relate more to things that Krishna does than relate more to Lord Chaitanya's activities than what goes on around here. The different unreal things of this world. So it's not so hard to think that there's plenty of stuff that we plenty of other things, to see. Depending on who you accept as an authority. I'm told so much stuff that you just can't relate to it here. But then, you read the books and they're saying this. It does seem like the realm of God.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah?
When you go back to the Godhead, you go back to serve Krishna. So, if a pure devotee doesn't really care where he is, but to serve Krishna. So, the material world, if you're a pure devotee, you like this spiritual world because you're serving Krishna. Wouldn't be any different. Because he doesn't care where he is, but he's serving Krishna.
Yeah, that's right. That's what Lord Chaitanya prayed. That I don't want beautiful women, I don't want wealth, I don't want followers, I don't want liberation, even meaning I don't want to have to go to the spiritual world and not have to come back. And then Prabhupada says, well, then all these no's, then what do you want? He said, all I want is to perform your devotional service in this life, in this world, life after life. So,
yeah, it doesn't matter.
Krishna Das, that's the last word.